5 p.m. I got to keep my energy up after those sports guys, man. They're going to make me sound like an old man if I don't talk fast and talk loud.
There's nothing difficult about getting your energy up for this show because it's double happy hour, triple happy hour because it's a long weekend.
Oh, my God. That really does add yet another notch on the awesomeness of Friday at 5 p.m. Time to celebrate. Well, you're probably in a car right now going somewhere cool. I hope you are. Even if cool means home for a rest after a long weekend. Or even, who knows, maybe some of you are actually going to work. I doubt many of you are doing that. But I'm glad you're there. Glad to have you aboard. On Friday, How Music Changed, we have been looking in depth at The Who for a number of weeks now. So if you're a Who fan, we are at a crucial part of their history at this point. We've done 33 hours on The Who so far, 33 shows. Incredible. This is show number 34, and we find ourselves in the year 1978. How did we suddenly get there, you may ask? Which makes sense, because it was only a few weeks ago where we played The Who by Numbers. Then we played Pete Townsend album that he did with Ronnie Lane called Rough Mix. And they were all like 74, 75, maybe a bit 76. What happened in 1977? Well, that was a very unproductive year for The Who. Keith Moon had moved to L.A., and the band pretty much like was taking a year off. They were not working together nearly as much as they had been in their prime. So when they did reconvene to record their next album, they had found that quite a few things had changed in the interim. And unfortunately, none of them were for the better, at least as far as, you know, their own futures were concerned. From the outside, think how much the music scene had changed, just as Pete Townsend had predicted, in the year 1977. When The Who by Numbers came out, The Who were pretty much at the top of their game, one of the most influential still and important rock bands in the history of rock and roll. 1977, all of a sudden, they risked being called dinosaurs. The punk rock scene left the band feeling as though they might have been in the dust. Pete had been saying that the music scene is bound to change. It's bound to change. And maybe we should get out while the getting is good. And then all of a sudden, punk rock hits. And it's impossible for The Who to embrace punk rock, which is really, in a way, odd.
It's odd, yes.
Because these are the guys that wrote, you know, Hope I Die Before I Get Old, My Generation. They provided, I would say, most of the fuel that generated punk rock in the first place. But the problem is, The Who changed a lot between 1964 and 1974. That decade did get them to feel, to basically hit the post-30 mark, which Pete felt was a cutoff that basically removed him from the ability to speak for a younger generation any longer. He just didn't think that he could be a spokesman. And now that punk had come in, very much fueled by the music of The Who, all of a sudden, Pete recognized this strange irrelevance that was beginning to set in. Now, the second major change that affected the band was an internal problem. Keith, the time that he spent in California, drastically changed his physical and mental condition, and it became quickly obvious as they reconvened to make the album that his talent had also waned considerably.
Ouch.
His paunch in his stomach was so large that when they needed to take the photo shot for the album cover, the band needed to pick a photo that had Keith sitting backwards on a chair.
Oh, no.
Because the back of the chair hit his midsection. There's other, I'll show you some of these. You got to see this, you know, there's pictures of the band standing up, and there's Keith standing up, and the buttons on his shirt are literally popping open around his belly.
Oh, my goodness.
So much was different. So now the question was, could The Who survive? At the time, we didn't realize that the question was much more literal than intended. So let's pick up where The Who were at. What was Keith doing in 1977? Well, he was writing demos, as he always did for the band, and recording demos. And as usual, the demos were pretty close to a finished product. All that the band had to do, for the most part, was dub their parts on. Keith would play drum parts onto Pete's demos. Roger would add his vocals, and John had the most work to do, of course, after Pete, because John would add bass and sometimes add horn parts and things like that to fatten out the parts. But at this point in time, as I said, Pete was obsessed with the state of music, and he started writing his theme at this point was writing songs about songs. He was writing music about music. Not at all sure where things were going. We had been through like the whole classic rock phase. Disco had become prominent, and he began to realize that things were beginning to get stale, which is certainly the impetus for his inspiration on this track. Here is the demo version of The Music Must Change.
Deep in the back of my mind is a realized sound. Every noise that I hear on the streets is soon to be found. When I hear the cold lies of the pushing, confirmed by the eyes of the kids emphasized with this. But the highs do rise from the low, like volcanoes explode through the snow. The mosquito sting brings the dream, but the poison's deranged. So the music must change. Oh, with you in a boom. You know it's so like the sparrow hawk flies, then we drop like a stone. Slowly in range, crushing mountains as old as the earth, so the music must change. Change. Sometimes at night I wake up and my body's like ice. The sound of the running wild stallion, the noise of the mice. And I wondered if then I could hear into all of your dreams. And I realize now it was really the sound of your scream. Death always leads unto life, but the street fighter swallows the knife. Am I so crazy to feel that it's here prearranged? The music must change. It gets higher and higher, smoldering like leaves in the sun. It bursts into fire, and its rhythm grows strong. Oh, so strong, so known, so strange. Just like bells in the clouds in a game, the music must change. Sting brings a dream, but the poison's deranged.
there you have it. A demo. Again, I mean, playing the demos, if nothing else, serves the point that Pete's was incredibly efficient at making the demos easy for the band to work around. We'll get back to the story of this song, though, later on when we get to the actual album version of it. That'll probably be for next week's show. But Pete's his feelings about what was going on around this time began to change as well, because he also noticed a shift in the band dynamic. This is taken from his own autobiography, Who I Am Right Now, that I'm about to read. Because Roger was demanding a bigger say in what he sang. His recent successful solo work had given him a new level of confidence and expressiveness as an artist. And although he wasn't always co-writing with the songwriters on his solo albums, he was always full of ideas and they listened to him. He became far more discriminating and choosy about what he wanted to sing with The Who. There was no longer a Stamp or Lambert to cajole him and convince him to trust my process, which meant that where once I might have spent 3 months writing songs for a new album, I now needed about a year, as I had with Quadrophenia. So if you're wondering what was happening in 1977, there it is. That's exactly it. But Pete has to reflect on the times. And later on in the book, here's what he says. Queen, Springsteen, AC/DC, they all found ways to stifle the infighting and conflict that The Who struggled with, too. I had even come to believe that our fans thrived on our arguments, and I tended to dramatize them in interviews. Roger always took the bait, and although there was no real war going on inside The Who, we had our share of trouble. Financially, because our companies only felt like they were a part of our life when we were on tour. Socially, because Keith was constantly going back and forth to L.A. And musically, because nothing new was happening, and neither Roger nor I had an easy idea for that. Continuing then, punk rock was a tsunami that threatened to drown us all in 1977. You could see it on the streets, hear it in the clubs, and even smell it in the air. I welcomed its arrival as a regenerative force in music, while being well aware of its potential to turn The Who and all of our generation into rock dinosaurs. It certainly gave us a compelling reason to snap out of our complacency and come up with something new. Punk was now established in London, and Keith would arrive at the 100 Club or the Vortex like Elizabeth Taylor stepping out from her Rolls Royce. He'd hold court at the bar, buying drinks for kids who wore zigzag eye makeup and safety pins in their clothes. They were mostly middle-class brats pretending to be tough. They threatened Keith, and he laughed at them, inviting them to come out and ride around in his car. I wasn't so brave. I went with him one evening and met Billy Idol. I thought he was pretty scary. And he made me want to act tough myself. So it's interesting then that Pete is definitely sensing the power of punk rock, but he's not absorbing it. In fact, what is happening is the management around him and the producers are basically taking Pete's material and trying to convince him to make an album that is aimed exactly at American corporate rock. And Pete seemed only too willing to acquiesce to that, probably not exactly sure what he could do otherwise. If he suddenly made a punk rock album, he would look like a fool or a poser. By absorbing what was happening and embracing the FM corporate rock thing that was happening, it would only distance him further from the scene that was developing. So he was in a tough spot. And the other type of music that was happening at the time, and was getting an awful lot of resistance, of course, was disco. So Pete wrote a demo about the status of disco, thinking that that was on its way out. Maybe, I guess his point of view here is, disco's going, rock is going to follow it. It's called Goodbye, Sister Disco on 90.3 WHPC. Here's the demo. Thank you.
beside you and comfort your soul when you are lonely and broken and old. Now I walk with a man in my face, a woman in my hair. I got you all looking out through my eyes. My dancing feet are a prayer. Goodbye, Sister Disco, with your flashing trash lamps. Goodbye, Sister Disco.
Demo of Sister Disco.
Get out of here.
What else was happening around this time? Well, Pete basically managed to find himself with an extra £1 million that he didn't have before because of the management change. A tremendous amount of things were going on where he had to pay more fees to, of all people, you know, because Alan Klein, of course, the bane of rock and roll.
Mm.
But he got involved in this case. And again, from Pete's autobiography, the meeting went on until the evening. I have never felt so stupid. The math was beyond me, even at its most basic level. I became weary as the day wore on, but Klein, by contrast, became more and more alert. He thrived on this kind of encounter. At 8 o'clock that evening, an agreement was reached. They would pay Klein the commission he demanded in order to release the money. They would also further reduce their share to give me an increase. So there they have it. So they decided to go out for a drink, and then this is Pete again. Let's go get a drink. He goes, and so we did. We went to the speakeasy that night where I met two of the Sex Pistols and started to preach at them, raging about money, after he had just been through this whole thing with Alan Klein. Until the very end, I thought Paul Cook, their drummer, was Johnny Rotten. I wasn't even that drunk, just angry about our submission to Klein. I should have gone home. But when I finally did get into my big limo, Tom Jones and the comedian Jimmy Tarbuck pulled alongside in a Rolls. Any birds in there? Their faces were full of hope. No, I replied, just a few dead bodies. And Pete ended up not quite making it home, falling down in a doorway, and wrote this song. Here is the demo of the song about that exact encounter in the speakeasy that night on 90.3 WHPC. We'll be right back. demo version of Who Are You, with that classic opening verse about encountering punk rockers, but certainly not copying the style of their music. Now, reading from the book put together by Richard Barnes called The Who Maximum R&B, Pete first talked about not touring in Trouser Press magazine in April 1978. "I've always tried to make sure that there was material that would work live, and it's never been used," said Pete. "Quadrophenia and Who by Numbers had a lot of raunchy material that never got on stage. All that seemed to work was a couple of old singles, the stuff from Tommy, a few rock and roll numbers, and finish. That was the act we went out and did again and again and again. And that was the act that we were acclaimed for. That was the list. And really, it wasn't a list. It wasn't an act. It wasn't a group. It wasn't anything. It was a celebration of our history. I'm fed up with doing it. I'm as much of a Who freak as any other Who freak, and I like what the band has done. I don't think there's anything as exciting as going into my generation and seeing people go crazy. But after a while, it's automatic. It's like being the Queen. People wave and shout just because you're there. They don't really care what you're doing. I've ceased trying to analyze that. I think that in itself, it's a wonderful thing. But in the end, for somebody like myself, when you realize the price you have to pay emotionally, with your family and with everything else, to actually go and hawk your body on the road for 6 weeks at a stretch, twice a year in the USA, I don't think it really gets the right results anymore." That exact sentiment is what inspired this outtake track from the sessions for Who Are You. It's called No Road Romance on 90.3 WHBC.
"When you look through the lights to the stage, you see the man of your dreams. You think his life's full of partisan love, but it's not what it seems. If you could see it in his room right now, you'd see how much never showed. There's never really any romance on the road. His forehead seems cut in two, the crease in his brow. He chews his nails and he fidgets, just trying to settle on down. The TV channels keep flipping, his adrenaline slowed. There's never really any romance on the road. Let's go! Laserbeam Tower. But you know he slept while the neon glowed. There's never really any romance on the road. There's never romance on the road, only frustration and all the load. He could fall in love, but he'd never know that she's only riding and he. He's sure to ask, but she won't say no. There's never really any romance on the road.
Song after song, what you really hear from Pete at this point is a real sense of frustration, ambivalence, all of that. About what he's doing. Again, from the Richard Barnes book, the group went into Rampart Studios, in December of 1977 to start work on their next album with producer Glyn Johns. Recording the album was to prove an arduous and frustrating experience. Keith was a major problem. Although he had moved back to England to live permanently once again, he was in bad shape and was drumming very badly. The very first day in the studios, he totally destroyed his drum kit. He walked straight through it and totally wrote it off, remembers John Astley, who was then the tape op. Then he was in reception looking at a new notice board that had been fixed up. He goes, "What's this notice board here?" he said. And he picked up a lighter that was on the desk and set light to the bottom of it. Nice. It started to flare up, much to Mooney's delight. And everybody just stood there thinking, "Should I interfere?" There was about 20 people watching it, but nobody dared move, wondering what he'd do next. He looked really wild, and they weren't sure if he'd set them on or not. If he'd set on them or not, excuse me. The whole thing was in flames, and the ceiling tiles were starting to catch. Finally, one of the Rampart engineers rushed over with the fire extinguisher and put it out. How does the album begin? With Keith writing a song about how we need a new song. Quite literally, yet another song. About songs. Here's the opening track from the album, Who Are You, on 90.3 WHPC, entitled New Song.
Something old. My fingers kill me as I'm bleeding.
Keith. I keep saying Keith. Yeah, if I'm saying Keith about songwriting, I do mean Pete. I guess I got Keith on my mind around this point in time. But you know, Pete being the songwriter, of course, that was his composition. Again, writing songs about songs. Now, the studio had a series of technical problems that delayed things over and over again. They stopped for a full month for Christmas. Soon after, the sessions were underway again, but Pete had cut his hand badly. He had been to visit his parents, and they all had quite a lot to drink. His parents had started to argue, and Pete tried to intervene. They were oblivious to him, and finally, in a fit of emotion, he smashed his hand through the window. As this only momentarily stopped them, he then rubbed his hand onto the broken glass, which had the desired effect, and his parents stopped their row and rushed him and his bleeding hand off to the hospital. But Pete's dramatic and theatrical gesture also effectively stopped him playing guitar for a month while the cuts healed. Not to be outdone, the band's newly hired keyboard player, Rabbit Bundrick, John, who was playing keyboards on a few of the tracks, broke his arm falling out of a taxi as he arrived at the studio door. John Entwistle was virtually co-producer on the album. He was in the studio every day, and he kept his eye on everything. When nothing else was happening, he'd replace his own bass parts again. This album has more John Entwistle songs than any other Who album. There are three on this track. Here are two of them back-to-back, starting with this track called Had Enough on 90.3 WHBC.
Mother was an incubator. Father was the contents of a test tube in the icebox in the factory of birth. My name is 905 and I've just become alive. I'm the newest populator of the planet we call Earth. Suspended animation, my childhood passed me by. If I speak without emotion, then you know the reason why. Knowledge of the universe is fitting to my mind. As my adolescent body left this puberty behind. Everything I know is what I need to know. Everything I do has been done before. Every sentence in my head, someone else has said. At each end of my life is an open door.
That track is called 905, just like the name of the lead character of the song. It's both of those songs back to back were John Entwistle songs. He was, the first track before that, Had Enough, I think that might be the first time that Roger Daltrey sang a John Entwistle song, rather than John singing it himself. But John here is offering some variety and also, quite frankly, some relief to Pete's intense analysis of music, songs, and the whole process of songwriting. We'll leave you with this song, the last one we're going to cover today from the album. We'll cover the rest of it next week. Yet another song, this time about songwriting, called Guitar and Pen on 90.3 WHPC. Thanks, folks. Enjoy this wonderful weekend. We'll see you next week.
As I walked through that hospital door, I was sewn up like a girl. Thank you.
You're alone above the street somewhere, wondering how you'll ever come out there. You can walk, you can talk, you can fight, but inside you've got something to write. In your hand you hold your only friend. Never spend your guitar or your pen.
Your guitar or your pen. Your guitar or your pen. Your guitar or your pen. Your guitar.
When you take up a pen.
You want.